Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, and Marco Sippi.
On the show today, Shape of Light, 100 years of photography and abstract art. We'll meet one of the New Tate Modern Events curators, Sarah Allen, to discuss the showcase that launched this week.
Plus, we'll hear from Joe Warwick, the food writer whose Where Chefs Eat series has put restaurant guides back in the hands of those who care most, the cooks in the kitchen.
And we'll meet singer-songwriter Luke Sital Singh and festival programmer Rachel Harris to discuss the Alchemy event at London's South Bank, highlighting the importance of multiculturalism and shining a spotlight on talent from the UK and across Asia.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco will be shining his own spotlight on next week's news. Eurovision spoilers ahead, and we'll try to fit in even more music too. All that ahead on the Monocle Weekly, here on Monocle 24.
Hello, Tom. How are you this weekend?
Marcus, I am loving it. London, bathed in warming sunshine. It's like a proper, normal city that has seasons and sunshine. I'm loving it.
Exactly. I'm very delighted to see that as well. And also, I think this is a historical day because I've never seen this before. You are wearing shorts.
A nice satirical device, Marcus. Regular listeners will know I don't believe in wearing shorts in the workplace.
Exactly.
Still wearing my trusty denim and keeping myself cool despite the summery temperature.
I think it's interesting. People have different perspectives when it comes to what to wear in the office. I think you and Fernando Augusto Pacheco are two extremes. So no matter what the weather, you are always wearing your jeans, normally blue jeans. Mm-hmm. And Fernando Augusto Pacheco, when it comes to, I don't know, 14 degrees in London, he's already finding his man thongs, or I don't know, I guess they classify as shorts still, but they used to be pretty short at some point.
He breaks out the shorts. I don't know what the record is. We'll have to ask him when he arrives in just a moment. I think maybe February. And he should know, Marcus, because he was an official Shorts Wearer of the Year award winner. We've talked about it before on this programme.
I think we should take this discussion elsewhere now.
So
what else have you been up to this week?
Very busy, as always. Lots of exciting things happening. One thing which we should mention to our global audience is to keep an eye out for the Monocle Drinking and Dining Directory. So exciting, Marcus. It covers your world as well, because obviously you're the producer of the menu on the radio.
But exactly. Well, that publication is out very soon, but I have to say that we already paid attention to that publication, or the latest edition of the menu, where we actually revealed which five restaurants we consider the best in the world. The results of the Monocle Restaurant Awards on the menu.
Just so exciting. And from that selection of award winners to surely the global leader in news look-aheads,
Monocle's own Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
There was something in the air that night. The stars were bright, Fernando. They were shining there for you and me, for liberty, Fernando.
Welcome, Fernando. Delighted to see, as I predicted, you're in shorts. I mean, it's mid 70 degrees, right, in London. What's happening this week, Fernando?
Well, this week is a fantastic week. You know, there's quite a lot of interesting stories happening. I had even trouble to find, you know, the best stories of the week, because there's so many. But shall we start in France? Cannes Film Festival starting on the 8th of May, this Tuesday. It's always very exciting. I think it's my favorite film festival. There's been a lot of controversies, you know, people saying Netflix is pulling out. But you know what? You know, so what? You know, there's still a lot of amazing directors in there, amazing films. And I look forward to see the films in the competition this year.
So what exactly are you looking forward to the most this time?
Well, there's quite a few of them. There's the new Spike Lee film, which is called Black KK Klansman, which is basically a black police officer, you know, in the 70s, and he tried to infiltrate the Ku Klux Klan. But basically, when there was a time to meet them in person, he sent like a white police officer instead. So I think it's a real life story. And since 91, Spike Lee haven't been to Cannes Film Festival. So who knows? it might be a winner again. There's also the new film by Iranian director Asghar Farhadi, and it's kind of a change of pace for him. He has a new Spanish psychological thriller with Penelope Cruz. So I look forward to see that.
Fernanda, what do you think about the importance of Cannes Film Festival? Is it as relevant today as it's been in the past years? There are so many film festivals, that's what I'm wondering over here.
Yes, there are, but I think Cannes is like the Oscars. You know, people, there's always like those articles every week. Does Cannes still matter? Yes, it does. Of course it does. You know, like, yeah, it's one of the most important festivals and will always matter.
So that's Cannes Film Festival. Is Eurovision still relevant?
Very relevant. That never lost its relevance. Actually, shall we move on swiftly to my next story? It's Eurovision. There's so many events happening. Tuesday is the day for the first semi-final, Thursday the second, and finally the big final on Saturday. And it's going to be in Lisbon, Portugal. I'm sure it'll be even sunnier than London today.
You are so into Eurovision. I wonder, when did you discover Eurovision? You must have been like 4 years old back in Brazil. Do you remember that day?
I was very young. You know, there's a community of Eurovision, Brazilian Eurovision fans. And every time I go, you know, to whatever the city last year in Kiev, there's always a group of Brazilians there holding the flags, you know. There's a strong connection there. When we had some artists, like this year we had the Latvian entry. She's Brazilian, Latvian-Brazilian. I like to mention that quite a few times.
Are there any good tricks this year from different songmakers and performers to try to get points? I remember that Finland, for example, my home country, once concluded that Finnish language doesn't sound beautiful enough when it's being sung. So someone wrote a song that where the lyrics only consisted of vowels. And I remember when the Helsinki Eurovision took place, the British entry was called Scooch.
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 Great Scooch.
Their strategy was to try to name as many European capitals in a song as possible. That didn't work out either. So any interesting tricks this year?
How about some chicken sounds?
So, Fernando, I know a little bit about Eurovision as well. I know this is the Israeli entry.
Absolutely. There was Netta with Toy. And, you know, I know I keep talking about her, but she is the front runner this year since the beginning. You know, surprises can happen on the day, but I do predict she'll win. It's a fun track. I think we need an upbeat track to contrast from last year's very sad ballad.
Anything else we should be paying attention to this coming week, by the way?
There are, actually. Basically, my home country, another, as you can see, is all my favorite topics, films, Eurovision, and Brazilian soap operas. It's going to, the latest soap opera called Outro Lado do Paraíso, The Other Side of Paradise, will end on Friday with the highest rating in the last 6 years. I think that's impressive. You know, everywhere around the world, you know, the ratings from the big broadcasters are being, you know, challenged by the streaming services. It's not the case in Brazil. And the soap opera, I have to say, was the critics didn't love it, but the public adores it.
Tell me about this specific episode of the soap opera. What happened in it? Was the plot particularly clever?
That's the thing. The plot is not particularly clever, but I think that's why the public love it in a way. Because, you know, this author, Valcir Carrasco, he's very much admired. But, you know, some critics didn't like because he... How can I say? His dialogue is very forceful. So, for example, if I have a discussion with you, Marcus, it's like, I'm going to kill you, bastard, you know? I tell you very... It's very straight. There's no, like, nuance. There's no side. But I think, to be honest, that's what the public wants sometimes.
Keeping things simple.
And there will be a lot of kidnappings and weddings in the last episode as well.
Fernando, it was great to have you in the studio again.
Yes, thanks as always, Fernando. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be getting a snapshot of the place where art and photography meet. Up next, hint, it's Tate Modern. Tate Modern is looking to visions of the future from this week by doing a bit of delving into the past. The Arts Institution here in London just opened its new exhibition, Shape of Light, 100 Years of Photography and Abstract Art, which includes perspective-bending works from the likes of Man Ray and Maya Rocha, and some new ones too from the likes of Daisuke Yokota.
The showcase looks to demonstrate how both the technical realm of photography and the uninhibited creativity of art share similar values. And Sarah Allen, assistant curator Gujarat Tate joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to the Monocle Weekly. So, Sarah, I always find it fascinating how you choose themes for your new exhibitions. What is the backdrop to this one? What is your thinking?
It's a really good question, actually. And I guess you could see this exhibition as a kind of culmination of a lot of what Tate Modern has been doing with photography since it started collecting and exhibiting photography in earnest back in 2009. So it's been the kind of mission of the museum to integrate photography within the history of art, to really show that those two histories never should have been separated and that they're very intertwined and they speak to each other in really interesting ways. So this is just a really great showcase of that.
Well, let's jump straight into that point, because this is often the kind of the battleground, insofar as it is one, and that is photography as art or as documentary. Are you sort of celebrating that conversation, often quite heated as it gets, or does it not matter? And do you sort of caution people not to be too prescriptive about it and just come and see the work and then review their opinion about it after the fact?
Absolutely. I think we've done a lot to kind of raise the status of photography over the last 10 years. And the conversation about whether it's art or not probably isn't so relevant anymore. I think a lot of people, certainly in London and globally, really have embraced photography as an art form. So really what we hope the viewer might take from this is to kind of see those really interesting moments of radical innovation and abstraction in photography and see how they relate to abstraction in the kind of broader discourse of art.
When you talk about that kind of innovation, who do you think are the most fascinating individuals? What have they come up with?
Yeah, there's just so much in the exhibition. I mean, it's really tracking a history of kind of radical experimentation in photography. And if you kind of look back to the 1920s, figures like Laszlo Moholy-Nagy really pioneered a new vision for photography in the way that they were photographing modernity and embracing the camera as the medium of modernity. But then if you go into the 30s, you've got experimentations with chemigrams, which is like manipulating chemicals and light in the darkroom, photograms. There's really just so much to be learned in this exhibition.
So let me ask you about this question. Is there I don't know, if we look geographically, do you think there's parts of the world where the art establishment, if you like, or just the viewing public, sort of get the abstraction of photography better? Because I guess this is a bit of a transatlantic narrative, isn't it? And some people sort of say, oh, well, you know, in America, they're sort of happier with the figurative. They're happier with street photography. They're happier with it as a sort of documentary form. I guess in one way, those big generalizations are entirely unhelpful. But do you think there is something to that? And is there a very different perspective, literally, as we go around the globe?
It's a really good question, actually, because we've tried to be really global in our outlook and when bringing works together for the exhibition. So we've got amazing works from Latin America. We've got works from Japan, from China. So you can kind of see that photographers all over the world are experimenting with the same processes and coming to sometimes similar visual conclusions, sometimes a little bit different. But certainly, if you look at America, certainly there was this moment that abstraction kind of took center stage. And we have recreated, well, partially recreated, and it's a partial homage to a 1960 MoMA exhibition within the exhibition at Tate to kind of track the history of abstraction and kind of highlight those really important moments that abstraction was so crucial and so in focus.
And from the 1960s to the present day, what would be some most exciting examples of experimentation you've come across recently?
So we have a section dedicated to the 1960s and 1980s. And in that, we've kind of looked at experimentations with op art. So Bridget Riley's op art paintings are the kind of anchor in that room, which enter into a dialogue with the photographers who are kind of replicating these op art processes by using kinetic devices to kind of experiment in the darkroom. But if you go right up to the contemporary moment, some of the most amazing digital innovations are to be seen in the show. For example, Thomas Roof has created a digital darkroom using bespoke software, and in it he has kind of simulated the play of light on surfaces and shapes. So there's this amazing kind of link back to the very early photograms you see in the 1920s, and then someone like Thomas Roof creating digital photograms today in a much different but also equally interesting way.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the selection process for the works, and also obviously some of the sort of photographic works maybe almost select themselves, but in terms of the abstract art pieces as well, which help to tell this story, you and your colleagues, and I know that one such is Simon, who Rob is going to be talking to on our programme at the Monocle Culture Show in a couple of weeks' time to get his perspective. But was it very collegiate? Do you have any dust-ups about what should be in, what shouldn't be in? I'm always interested in the actual nitty-gritty of the curatorial process.
We got on extremely well. There was no fisticuffs, no, not at all. But your question about what paintings and sculptures are included is really interesting, and it kind of is a showcase of the Tate's collection, and because the majority of the paintings and sculptures have been drawn from the Tate's collection. So we've chosen those kind of moments that really speak to photography. So we've paired Kandinsky with a German photographer, Martha Hofner. We've paired Georges Braque with this really early, very early abstract photograph by Pierre de Broglie. So those decisions kind of came very naturally.
And just on this point about Tate modernizing, embracing photography. So what are we talking, sort of certainly 10 years or so at least? Are there still stick in the muds or sticks in the mud? Do you still get people, I don't know, if as you wander around stealthily listening to what your visitors have to say, do you still hear people saying, well, this shouldn't be in here? And is that actually quite, I don't know, do you sort of like to hear that in a way, because you're sort of getting some good discussion going?
It's been a long time since someone, to me anyway, questioned the place of photography, because it's so much in the DNA of the institution
but
now.
But there are people, though, who still, I don't know, maybe they're real sticklers. Maybe there's just these small C conservatives that I'm talking to, but who still kind of can't quite get on board with it. I don't know. I mean, why is that?
It's so interesting, because actually photography is such a relatable medium. It's so democratic. Everyone has a photograph. Everyone is engaging with photography constantly. It's one of the most relatable art forms, I feel. So actually, we find that our photography shows are very popular in Tate, because people really do get them and really do enjoy them.
What do you think, when people come and see those pieces of art, what would you want to see them take with them from that exhibition?
Definitely, I think seeing the photographs in dialogue with these kind of very iconic paintings and sculptures that many people will have seen in Tate's collection, that they could be very well known to people. I think hopefully when they leave the exhibition, they'll be looking at those very famous paintings in a different light by seeing them in dialogue with the photographs, and hopefully seeing them through a new lens.
And what about you? I wonder if you learned something when you were putting this exhibition together.
There were some gems that were unearthed in the process of bringing the exhibition together. We've got Man Ray's unconcerned photographs, which are just super special, amazing images that he took when he was invited to this 1960s MoMA show. He took them in his Paris studio by swinging the Polaroid camera around at random. And the Polaroid camera sped out these shots. He sent them to MoMA and said, you know what, you make the prints. I'm not interested in making the prints myself. It was this lovely kind of Dadaist gesture, like, you know, I don't care about the photographic medium. And he called them unconcerned photographs, which now is actually kind of mimics, or at least speaks to, what is engraved on his tombstone in Montparnasse Cemetery: unconcerned but not indifferent, which I always think is quite nice.
Very nice. Yeah, too clever. Too clever for his own good. Just going back to that point you made about the sort of democratizing the accessibility, I guess, of photography. You know, everyone goes on these days about, oh, you know, everyone's a photographer now, even if it's only amateur, because we have our camera phones always on us at every moment. I don't know, how does that shift the landscape quite profoundly? Because everyone is an amateur, you know. I mean, I guess people have long had cameras and wandered around, but it wasn't as ubiquitous as I guess it is now. Does that change, or threaten to change, how people view photography? I appreciate this isn't even just a sort of specifically art-based question, but I don't know, is that still reshaping that landscape of how people engage?
I think you can look at it in a really positive way and just think that we're all becoming so visually literate in this language of photography. Everything we do is engaging with photography on a daily basis. We're all becoming, experts in that, in reading photographs.
Even if it's just to present a face to the world on our Instagram or whatever it might be. Is it all good, I guess? That's my question. Is that all good because people are becoming more literate?
Well, in my opinion, it definitely is. We definitely had some selfies in our previous Tate
Modern
show.
Oh, they get everywhere, don't they?
No selfies in this show.
a relief to many, I'm sure. Sarah, it's great to speak with you. The exhibition is Shape of Light, 100 Years of Photography and Abstract Art. It's on now. Do get along and see more. And you can hear more, as I mentioned, Marcus, on our Monocle Culture show in a couple of weeks. So
exactly.
Plenty to enjoy. Marcus, it's interesting. Fernando was talking a bit earlier about Eurovision, of course. I think it's music time right now on the programme.
Exactly, I like the idea of music. And now, from their seminal 1980 album, Remain in Light, see what we did there, it's Talking Heads with Born Under Punches. Born Under Punches, the heat goes on there from Talking Heads. What a track.
I love Talking Heads, Marcus. I've probably mentioned that on the programme before. Wherever you are in the world, hope you're enjoying the programme and do stay with us. We'll be talking more tunes before the end of the programme. But first, we're learning where chefs eat.
After this.
Food writer Joe Warwick co-founded the world's 50 best restaurants guide until the airs and graces of stuffy Michelin-starred dining began to feel like he was missing out on something more real, spots more accessible and perhaps more tasty too.
So he founded the equally successful Where Chefs Eat book and app series instead, with the no-nonsense guide nudging food lovers in the direction of smaller, more affordable and generally more off-the-beaten-track places that chefs themselves head to for a good feed. It's found immense popularity and is now in its third edition.
Earlier, he sat down with Monocle's Tom Hall to explain how the series is evolving. Tom began by asking how he decides the criteria for picking the list.
This started in 2012. This is the third one. In many ways, this was a reaction to what I worked on before, which was the world's 50 best restaurants, which was a collection of Michelin three-star restaurants that were incredibly expensive, that everybody knew about. It was hard to get reservations for. And what I wanted was something really useful that covered that whole range of places. So the name is very straightforward, and that's exactly what it is. I mean, we surveyed these chefs right from the beginning, and we asked them to pick places and put them in different categories. I'm a bit of a geek. I love putting restaurants in categories. So they're picking places for breakfast, they're picking places for late night, they're picking bargain places, they're picking high-end places. There's a category called worth the travel, which should probably be the one category where they're not looking at their local knowledge. There's another one called wish I'd opened, which again would probably be more of those Michelin three-star fancy fine dining places. But the rest of them is just about thinking, you know, if I go somewhere, even if I'm going to visit a high-end restaurant, say I'm going to Copenhagen, I'm going to Noma, I'm going to the new Noma, I'm still going to want lunch the next day. I'm still going to want somewhere to go for breakfast. I'm still going to want a good place to grab coffee. And I think chefs are actually really well plugged in to their local dining scenes in a really good way and just quite straightforward. That's what we're asking them to do. We're not rating and ranking places. This is just their own personal choices. And I think what's nice, because we put their names by the restaurant as well, you know, if they're going to recommend somewhere that's not up to par, that's almost as bad as they're putting out bad food in their own restaurant, because, hey, this is Rani Redzepi's breakfast place. You know, it's his reputation he's staking by naming this place.
And it is hugely subjective when you look through there.
Isn't everything?
Well, of course, of course. And that's kind of one of the kind of simple joys of this book, as you've said. There's not some hugely complicated metric where if someone reviews something glowingly and you go there and you don't enjoy it, fair enough. It's like you have your own opinion too, but it's good that you've been pointed in the direction of these places that don't get talked about as much.
I mean, I think by putting them in those categories, people kind of know what they're going to get. And yeah, there shouldn't be too many surprises there. It's not meant to surprise people. It's not meant to test people. It's not meant to be complicated. It's meant to be useful and it's meant to be straightforward. And I know for me, because people go, oh, have you eaten in all the places in it? And I'm like, yeah, I think what's the current one? We've got 7,000 recommendations, 6,000 different places. I'm like, yeah, I've eaten in them all. But actually, if I go to a place I haven't been before, you know, the first thing I do is I look at it and I always try them out. And actually, you know, most of the time, I'd say 99% of the time, they do the job.
Who are some of the chefs that we're talking about in this book? Because, I mean, we've got some big names, we've got some lesser-known names. Who are some of the people pointing you in the direction of these places?
Oh, well, all sorts of different chefs. I mean, here in the UK, who did I talk to? I talked to Merlin LeBron-Johnson, who is from Portland and Klipstein. I talked to Sean Searley from the Quality Chop House. I've talked to the guys from The Marksman, to John, I've talked to Fergus Henderson. I've talked to, you know, all sorts of people. So it's a mixture of the big names, you know, Fergus Henderson, René Redzepi, Magnus Nielsen, David Chang, etc. The kind of people you expect. And then, you know, younger, upcoming guys. And this edition is different from previous ones because whereas before I kind of did all the chef selection myself, I'm working with three different editors. So I've got a great editor in New York, who's David Joshua Stein. I've got a fantastic editor in Australia, who's Natasha Marouche. I've got a great editor in Asia, in Singapore, called Evelyn Chan. And I said, listen, can you come up with some names to talk to this time? So it wasn't just me all the time, because I'm pretty plugged into what's going on in the UK, yeah, and you know, Europe, but less so when it comes to those other regions. But it does these fantastic things that I have actually got to try. I mean, I think chefs are very, very good at late night places because of the hours they keep.
I was going to ask you about this.
Less so at breakfast. Less so at breakfast. Maybe when they get older, they're a bit better at picking breakfast places, or, you know, they know the weekend brunch places. But late night, you know, they are superb.
Well, I was going to ask, though, when you first started making these books, you know, a couple of volumes ago, before people like completely grasped the concept, did you sort of find maybe on like a lot of first answers, because of the sort of nocturnal nature of chefing, that people were just accidentally recommending bars rather than restaurants?
Well, look, I think because it was clear that what we wanted were restaurants, but definitely the late night places, there'll be a bar element there. There's izakayas in Tokyo. There's this place in Istanbul which serves these things called wet burgers, which are supposed to stand out in Istanbul with everyone doing kebabs. This guy in the late 70s set up this thing doing what he called wet burgers, which is basically like a hamburger that you put in a steam cabinet, okay, and cover in chili sauce, which are the most incredible things. So little wacky things like that. And I think those are the things that get me excited, you know. Those are the things that I find interesting.
Are you seeing a sort of change in trend at all across these volumes? I mean, are you seeing chefs sort of gravitating towards maybe slightly different sorts of locations as they might have maybe 2 or 5 years ago? Are you able to spot anything like that?
I mean, predominantly we're looking for their local knowledge. So we want the London chef telling us about London, you know, the New York chef telling us about New York, et cetera, et cetera. I think if there's one trend that's been there from the beginning, particularly if chefs work in very fancy places where they're using tweezers to plate things, actually when they go out, they want something that's casual, that's very direct, that's tasty, but, you know, they don't really want to go to fancy restaurants in their downtime. They will go to some of those when they pick, you know, Worth the Travel or Wish I'd Opened, and they'll go for professional curiosity. But actually, generally speaking, off-duty chefs want casual, good food. They don't want fancy, complicated places.
In London, I mean, we are constantly being told that, especially young diners, you know, all the stereotype is that they only care about their brunch and their avocado on toast. And this is supposedly why no one can buy a house, because they're spending all their money on it. This is what we're told.
This is the narrative, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I think we can try and kick against that. What kind of eating spots are maybe trying to buck that trend in slightly interesting ways? Or is comfort food just really some of the best dining there is? Are people trying to do interesting things with menus that aren't necessarily, you know, your high-class sort of evening eating spot?
I think with eating out in London, well, what's changed in my experience, and I've been here like 25 years, and what's great now is you have places, fine dining, what does fine dining mean anymore? But you have places that are casual, that are laid back, where you can just go in and have a starter and a glass of wine if you want, and it's a pit stop rather than it having to be a three-course meal. And there's lots of great places like that. I mean, there's a place like Lyle's I love. Everyone talks about Lyle's, but Lyle's is great. It's open all day, you know. You can go in there. They've now got a bar menu. You can just have a snack and a glass of wine. And places that are doing things like that, where there's fantastic produce, where there's some real skill and thought going into the food in the kitchen, but you don't have to have a whole meal and you don't have to invest a lot of money. It's just really nice plate of food that you can go in and have that. And there's places like that I think are really interesting. It's not all about brunch. It's not all about avocado on toast.
Do you find when you're making a book of this volume, because it obviously requires a ton of research and it must take quite a while to compile, do you find that the restaurant culture in London moves so fast that sometimes maybe you'll be like enthusing about a really great new spot at the beginning of the process, and by the time you're publishing, it's gone? Because I notice that places come and go so quickly.
I mean, that's the problem with books. Books are beautiful. We all love books. And yeah, there are, I'm not sure how many, but there'll be a couple of places that will have fallen or moved or relocated since that went to press. But we've got an app version of the book as well. And what's nice this time, they've done something at Fyden that I wish we'd done sooner, but it's great we're doing it now, is if you buy the book through Fiden as opposed to someone else, you get the app as well included. And keep the book, which is, I mean, the design of it's beautiful. I think that's one of the reasons it's been a success, apart from the concept and the name and the content and all of that. I think it's a beautiful looking book, you know, playing on these old directories that the designer did. So that looks great on your bookshelf, and you can flick through it at home and mark places off. And then you can take the app with you on your phone, and it's got location services. So, you know, you're nearby, it pops up.
And it is super straightforward to use. It feels like a phone book, but with really, really delicious places contained within. That wasn't a very flattering thing to say. It feels like
a phone book. It's as sexy as a phone book. It's a delicious directory. There's a bit of alliteration for you as well.
Yeah, we might keep that in. But I wanted to just stay on that topic of places coming and going. Do you think that's a particularly London thing? Because I live in Homerton, which has a sort of strip of quite good like brunch spots. And I noticed Jim's Cafe is in there, which is quite near me, and a couple of others. But I went through a period, like maybe a year ago, where on the main street there, about three of my favourite places, these comfort food places, which you kind of don't really view as being highly competitive and, you know, sort of striving for massive awards or anything, they kept shutting one after the other. And I felt like maybe is there something slightly deeper going on there, maybe in the sort of business culture of London where, you know, landlords, this is something that I just drew from it, but are they so like money hungry that maybe small businesses aren't really given a chance to kind of establish a customer base or a following.
I think the restaurant business has always been very competitive, and I think the margins are a lot smaller than a lot of people imagine from the outside. We've had this period where over the last decade we've had more restaurants opening than closing, and we've had this great boom. But what's starting to happen is as the fixed costs are going up, as utilities are going up, as rent is going up, all those things are going up. And so restaurants are being squeezed. And so sadly, there's a few places that are going under. And I don't think that's just London. I think, you know, that happens in New York. That happens in a lot of big cities. I think what's going on with our currency as well at the moment on the back of Brexit, you know, wine is bought in euros, fish is bought in euros. That hasn't helped. The way the restaurant industry has improved in this country since the 90s is incredible. And, you know, and in London, it'd be nice if we could get some support from the government, local and national, to look after restaurants and to help them and to encourage them, because it's a great employment provider as well. You know, and the other crisis in restaurants, and I don't think it's too much of a overstatement to call it a crisis, is a staff shortage. You know, we haven't got enough people to wait tables. We haven't got enough people to cook in kitchens. Again, what's happening with Brexit scaring away our friends from Europe isn't helping with that. So I think the answer is it's always been a volatile business. And I think, yes, the costs in London, the price of rent and all of those things are making it harder. I don't know if the statistic about, you know, a third of all restaurants failing in the first year is still true, but I think it's a very tough business.
It could just be that I like crap restaurants as well.
That's the other possibility. You've just got really poor taste in restaurants. You know,
it is a real thing, though. I mean, I think there was that restaurant Ellery in Nettle House, and it was like Michelin starred, and it at least had to move location because of the rent. And you just wonder what's going on. It's like it doesn't feel very.
Well, I mean, I know, and I'm not going to mention the name of the restaurant, but you know, I know a very successful restaurant that does great food, that's full for lunch and dinner. Lunch almost every day, dinner every day. And they're struggling because of that thing about the margins. So what do? Do they put up the price of their food and alienate the customers they've already got? Do they scrimp on the quality of the produce that they're buying and, again, upset their customers? So it's very hard at the moment. I think on the one hand, you've got the big chains that are failing, you know, Jamie Oliver and all that, because I'd like to think because people are getting wiser and realise for the same money they can get something better. And on the other hand, you've got these independent businesses that are doing things the right way but are struggling, and it's tough. So, you know, there's economies of scale with catering like everything else and with restaurants. And so it's hard as an independent. And yet, if you're a Londoner and you're into food in your restaurants, mostly it's independent restaurants you're going to want to be eating in, you know.
And finally, chefs are a very particular breed of person. It can be an incredibly tough job. It's quite antisocial in some ways. Do you think you would get a different result if you were to ask maybe where waiters eat or where accountants eat or some other profession?
Probably. I mean, I think the good thing about chefs is, you know, I think the hospitality industry. I think chefing has changed a lot. I think the fact we've now got open kitchens means everyone behaves a lot better because they have to. But I think the culture is changing. I think we've got a lot more women working in restaurants, both in kitchens and front of house. So, yeah, you would get, if you asked a different profession, you'd get different answers. I don't think you'd get better answers.
Yeah.
I think it would be interesting to do this with restaurateurs, you know, as opposed to just cutting it off at chefs. But that's that was the shtick for the book, so we stuck with chefs. But, I mean, I think generally people in the industry, you know, sommeliers, waiters, people in the restaurant industry, as well as being passionate about their own restaurant and their job, they're passionate about eating out. And they all go, oh, you know, if they're going somewhere, they're excited. They want to try the new place, and they'll have heard about the latest place, and they'll have a friend that they worked with that's moved somewhere and is doing something new. So that's why the chefs and the restaurant industry in general are a really good source of finding out about new restaurants.
Joe Warwick there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Hall, and Where Chefs Eat, Volume 3, is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We'll be hearing from singer-songwriter Luke Sitel Singh in just a moment. He takes to the stage for London's Alchemy Festival this weekend. But first, here's an exclusive session he's recorded just for us. This is his new single, Weight of Love.
She arose from a rose bed, all alone and a little scared, to feel the weight of love. With a box full of all the dreams, looking for a life and if anything, to feel the weight of love. Early light across her face, so much time but none to waste, to know the weight of love. Oh, she longs to find it, but it's wild and it's blinding, to know the weight of love. She lets go and runs up to the highest place she knows, just to feel her heartbeat rise above her life below. She says it might take everything I've got, but I'm afraid to be forgotten like everything I've lost. Oh, this is how the future starts. Oh, I know I'm not old yet, but I know what it feels like to hold the weight of love. Dark clouds in the mind, sweet fire on the skyline, oh, the weight of love. Oh, the weight of love. I let go, I run up to the highest place I know, just to feel my heartbeat rise above my life below. I know it might take everything I've got, but I'm afraid to be forgotten like everything I've lost. Oh, this is how the future starts. Oh, oh, we are dust becoming stars. Oh.
Luke Sitel Singh there with Weight of Love. Luke will be at the Queen Elizabeth Hall at London South Bank Centre on Sunday, the 6th of May. Tonight, as the site welcomes back Alchemy Festival, the music, arts, food and performance series celebrates the common ground between the UK and cultures from Asia and beyond.
I'm delighted to say that Luke joins us on the line now. And in the studio, we have Rachel Harris, creative producer for the festival development at South Bank Centre, who's been working on the festival for the past 9 years. A warm welcome to you both. Luke, I'll start with you. Congratulations on that record. That was absolutely beautiful, haunting stuff. I guess what people have come to expect from you. Will it be more of the same at your set tonight? Is that what's in store?
Yes, it's a very happy, chirpy event. But yeah, I mean, songs like that. And I also play piano, and they have a very beautiful piano there for me, which I'm looking forward to twinkling on. It's no dance tracks, that's for sure.
Rachel, you have indeed been working with this festival for the past 9 years. More widely, what is this festival all about, or what is its mission? How would you define that?
So what we've been trying to build over the last 9 years is to give visibility and to give a platform really at its heart for wonderful artists and wonderful work. So that's the central mission. But what we're trying to do is draw a link between the cultural connections between Britain and the Indian subcontinent. So India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Afghanistan, Nepal, particularly from that kind of very British heritage perspective. So if the festival were in a different European city, it would feel different. There's something about the cultural contribution of diaspora communities as well in this country that's really, really exciting and thrilling and has led to the development of the art forms themselves. So what we've been trying to do is proactively look at the balance between bringing work from abroad, so it's not just a sort of showcase of work that we're disconnected with, and make it a very British-rooted festival as well, and look at the contribution of those diaspora communities. From experience, we've found that we're also, of course, dealing with underrepresented artists and art forms. So we feel an obligation that this is something that throws the spotlight on those artists, and we can give opportunity, nurture young talent, as well as really bring to the UK some of the sort of global artists.
And Luke, that must be really exciting to be part of something like that. And I guess it is interesting. This is a moment where in Britain there's lots of conversations about our diverse culture and heritage, the diversities within the population more broadly. I guess it must delight you to be part of a festival that looks to celebrate exactly that and all of that richness at a time when there's, frankly, some pretty sort of unsavoury noises being made by rather more people than anyone would be comfortable with.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. For me, unlike on a personal note, this is a kind of a voyage of discovery for me. I wasn't sort of brought up first in Indian culture or anything on my father's side, but it kind of went back a few generations. So like when I get invited to do things like this, it's a chance for me to kind of learn something that I actually didn't know about my heritage. And my career has enabled me to go and play in India a few years ago, which was amazing. So yeah, part of that, this is like one of these events that I'm kind of coming into sort of as part of this community, but and also as like this kind of outsider learning with eyes open, trying to understand and learn a bit more about where I'm from. So it's a great thing.
Luke, how important do you think it is, representation of diversity in British culture at major festivals such as this?
I think it's important. There's so much going on out there, and I'm guilty of being quite narrow-minded in the things that I listen to sometimes, and I get complacent with all the different flavours of, say, let's just say music that is out there. So for me to kind of have something like this, I don't live in London anymore, but I used to, but to just be able to go to these things so easily and experience something new and of quality is really important in the arts and culture in general, yeah.
Rachel, maybe you can tell us a bit about how over the days already that have passed of the festival and indeed on through tonight and into tomorrow, how you're trying to reflect the kind of themes that Luke and that you've been talking about already. What's some of the makeup? I mean, give us, you know, what would be a kind of a couple of the standouts so far and things you're still looking forward to?
I think, first of all, it's important to just mention that as a curator and as speaking on behalf of the venue, we would never wish to confine what artists are doing or just according to their heritage. So the festival is about what excites artists, and then it's up to us to sort of shape it to make it interesting and understandable to the general public. And we're also, the phrase general public is kind of meaningless as well. They're made up of many, many different types of communities. So we do take into consideration making sure there are sort of serious, more reflective moments, like last night's Sharper Than a Serpent Tooth, where we, newcomers to the festival, Priti Taneja and Mona Arshi, discussed the reinterpretation of literary classics, so about how language changes across borders and down generations, and also touching on political issues. So we had The Troth, which is a newly commissioned dance drama about the input of Indian soldiers in the First World War. And then just let your hair down, communal moments like listening to Ezu Free in the foyer. So we have ticketed events, non-ticketed events, and a mixture of cutting-edge contemporary dance right through to Bollywood.
What kind of process has it been to create this year's festival? I'm wondering, from the curator's point of view, I would imagine you started working on this year's festival probably over 10 months ago already. So how did you build all this?
So it's cumulative. So we obviously have set programming deadlines and structures that mean that you're keeping up with logistical and marketing deadlines. But really, all year, it's about being open to listening to ideas from all over the world. Luckily, now we've built a brand so that lots of really interesting and informed people send ideas to us. Also going out and seeing as much as possible, and then not promising things too early, waiting until you get a sense of what the temperature of the year might be, and then forming things into strands, shaping the festival, making sure there's things for families and things for older people, and that kind of breadth of impact.
I think it's interesting that you said that you've got more name now. I wonder what it was like 9 years ago. Do you feel like you have achieved something?
Well, I hope something. So we've tried to be objective. It's an absolute privilege that we've had world-class artists. We've had thousands and thousands of audience members. So that's showing that something's right. Also, we've worked very, very hard. For example, last year we had an equal balance of work emanating from Pakistan as India, which you can imagine it's kind of easier logistically and for many other reasons to invite work from India. So that's incredibly important to us, that parity. I would say we can be braver now. I mean, in the first festival, we started big with A.R. Rahman, the wonderful composer and musician. But Luke and I were chatting about this the other day, that in the first iteration, the first few iterations, we wanted to avoid Bhangra and Bollywood because we felt that that's their first inclination to expect that from a festival relating to India. Whereas I was very clear that this was something more subtle and more nuanced about identity. But now that people know what we're trying to achieve, then we're happy to invite all art forms, and we feel that we can, with a careful framing, avoid stereotyping, avoid that kind of exotification of work from abroad as well.
And Luke, perhaps I can ask you a bit about that process of sort of defying expectation and surprising people in terms of your records. You know, we heard Weight of Love, which is obviously on the EP. Are you mindful of that? I mean, do you just kind of go where your musical fancies take you? Are you sort of aware that your audience might have expectations? I mean, we go back to sort of, you know, your sort of big breakouts, what, 6 or so years ago now, I guess 2012, things like Fail Future. Do you sort of think about that, or are you just driven by your creative juices and what's flowing on any given day?
I think it's a constant war with myself, really. I mean, I'm very conscious of wanting to be this sort of like pure artist and go, yeah, I don't care about the audience and I'm just going to do what I do. And if no one likes it, whatever. But, you know, then the reality strikes where you're paying the bills and you're like, if people don't like it, then I'm in a bit of a pickle. So I'm a people pleaser, like as a character. So that voice always comes in. But I think I am writing songs that I'm trying to connect to other people. That's the kind of songwriting that I love. It's these songs that kind of connect us all and people relate to. So there is an element where I'm sort of thinking about that, whilst at the same time, the sort of paradox of that is the more insular I get and the more that I turn that voice and worry off, the more my songs become more universal because I get really honest and kind of honest to my own struggles and whatever I'm feeling. And those are the ones that really connect widely.
You mentioned that word honest there, and I know you've talking about the new record before, you've talked about this idea of honesty in your songwriting, I guess, in the songs, being honest about, you know, the kind of the struggles that everybody faces, and there's sorrow in there, but there's also hope and there's something upbeat. Not wishing to sort of parachute metaphors into your work where none perhaps exist, but again, it feels like a bit of a moment, doesn't it? Certainly here in the UK at the moment, there's lots of stuff to be depressed about, but I guess we have to find these sort of paths of light through it all. Are you happy if your record lights the way for a few people?
Oh, of course, yeah, I'll go with that. Parachute away, that's a good one. I'll take that.
Rachel, if we look at what's been happening, say, in the UK in the last 10 years, it's interesting that people have become more interested in food. And obviously, food aspect is something that is very relevant when it comes to this festival as well.
That's right. And we like to define culture, of course, in the widest possible way. And if the fundamental objective, which you asked at the beginning, is really to bring people and ideas together, one of the best ways of doing that is through sharing food. And if I may say, amongst colleagues, the Alchemy Food Market, which we do in collaboration with Curb, is a highlight of the year. I just love walking through there and seeing families who don't usually come into central London, maybe enjoying themselves, dwelling. And of course, we're having amazing weather this weekend. So please come on down.
Well, yeah, to that point, can I be probably the 1,000th person to say it's a food for culture, literally and metaphorically. Rachel and Luke, thank you so much for chatting to us. And Luke, for that beautiful track we heard earlier. Those in London today can head to the Queen Elizabeth Hall on South Bank for Luke Sital Singh's show tonight at 8 p.m. How could you not do that after what we heard? And do head down tomorrow for the festival's final day, I gather, Rachel.
Absolutely.
Plenty still to enjoy.
If you come to Luke's show, we've got a wonderful after show with the Scarvengers, so bringing in sort of summer, dub, punk, etc. And then tomorrow, classic South Bank Centre Festival, we've packed loads in. If you have a family, come and see a beautiful children's show, The Magic Fish, and you can do beatboxing and dance workshops. We've got Spirit of India, which is representing Shai Mukhtarvar's whole UK dance extravaganza, looking at the greatest Bollywood hits. That's a wonderful dance show. Tez Ilyas talking about culture and identity. Wonderful comedian. Please come and see him and support there. He's a very clever man. And then the culmination, Talvin Singh, who's incredibly celebrating 20 years of his Mercury award-winning album.
There is so much going on. Thank you very much, Rachel, and thank you, Luke. You are listening to The Monocle Weekly.
Well, Marcus, there you have it. Edition 461. Count them, of the Monocle Weekly. What a delight. So much cultural sustenance for us. Literal sustenance, talking great food. A show that had everything.
A lot of inspiration, I have to say, even for this coming week. I know which exhibition I'm going to be going to, and I know which book I'll be looking at when I'm planning my future travels.
Let's raise a glass, given we're talking about that, to the people behind the glass. Today's programme was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio managers were Cassie Galpin and George McDonough.
This was the edition 461 of the Monocle Weekly. The Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Markus Hippi.
And it's goodbye from me, Tom Edwards.